mouth. And it came to me there was hardly any difference between what I did now and what I had done then, for her sleep had been a death. The notion ravaged me with guilty horror. I do not know how much time passed while I attempted to manipulate her lifeless body, but when the sound of voices at last broke into my waking nightmare, the sun was far in the west and cast long beams which fell with a peculiar lateral intensity over the sand. She and I were now both utterly bedaubed with wet sand, so that we looked like those Indian shamans who paint themselves with colored mud when they want to summon back the spirits of the departed. And I was attempting to do no more than that. I looked up. On the promenade, I saw a dark, humpbacked figure who gesticulated in my direction with a white stick. Down the iron steps to the beach clattered a posse of the Determination Police in their long leather overcoats, and at their head ran the clerk from the town hall, an unusual animation contorting his features, and the housekeeper from the mayor's house, still in her white apron, plumply stumbling, crimson and breathless, but radiating a horrid gratification. These two formed the very picture of malevolent glee, and I was seized with the conviction they had, in collusion, murdered the mayor for reasons of their own, probably connected with money or property, and trusted to the confusion of the times to hide their guilt. They thought I might discover it. Perhaps they had even murdered poor Marianne, too, and dropped her into the sea in order to frame me. For how could I accuse them if I was myself accused? They all came nearer and nearer and nearer, and I realized I must quickly run away. I do not know why I scooped up the dripping corpse of the girl in my arms and tried to make my escape with her. I think I wanted to rescue her from the housekeeper, for I knew with instantaneous clairvoyance the old woman hated her, dead or living. Burdened with Marianne, I lurched along the beach for perhaps 100 yards while she, twice her weight with water, slithered about so that it was like carrying a huge fish. Then one of the Determination Police drew his pistol and fired. I felt a tearing pain in my shoulder and fell. The second bullet whistled past my ear, and while I watched, shattered the exquisite rind of the dead girl's features, so that her blood and brain spattered over my face. At that, I fainted. I was charged on 4 counts. 1, obtaining carnal knowledge of a minor, for in fact Marianne had been even younger than she looked, only 15 years old. 2, procuring death by drowning of the said minor. 3, practicing necrophily on the corpse of the said minor, which act the police had witnessed with their own eyes. And 4, posing as an inspector of veracity class 3, when I was really the fatherless son of a known prostitute of Indian extraction, an offense against the Determination Regulations, page 4, paragraph 1C, viz. Anything or person seen to diverge significantly from it or his own known identity is committing offense and may be apprehended and tested. From the look in the eyes of the Determination Police, it seemed very likely to me that I would not survive the testing in order to stand my trial. I was terrified to realize how much the autonomous power of the police had grown. Although I pleaded with him to let me telephone the minister's private number, they laughed at me and beat my head with the butts of their pistols. The papers in my briefcase had, of course, all been altered so that they presented masterpieces of the dubious. This was clearly the work of the clerk, done while I examined the files. My weapons were all gone, everyone. I was uncertain of the role of the peep show proprietor in all this, except that clearly he wished to be rid of me. And all the time I was waiting for him, he had himself been blindly spying on everything I did. All the cells in the police station were filled with reality offenders, so they took me to the town hall and put me in the mayor's office. They had tied up my wounded shoulder in a rough sling, and treated it only with a dose of dilute carbolic acid. But at least they were sensitive enough to let me wash away Marianne's blood. They gave the clerk an overly melodramatic machine gun and posted him outside the door to make sure I did not escape. I heard the key turn in the lock and a harsh retreating clang of the heels of their jack boots. After a while, I heard a cackle of female laughter, and then nothing more. It was now night, and the room was in utter darkness. I was in considerable pain, but a seething fury kept me from despair. I knew I should sleep a little to clear my disoriented brain enough to face the ordeal I knew next day would bring. But sleep was out of the question. Besides, I was ravenously hungry and dry as a bone. I felt my way to the bureau to grope for the decanter of mayoral sherry, and discovered there an airtight tin of Marie biscuits, too. So I munched them all down in spite of their earthy flavor. I pulled the stopper from the decanter with my teeth. The sherry had turned to liquid demerara sugar, but I managed to keep it down. And it and the food gave me sufficient strength to seat myself at the mayor's desk and look at my situation coolly. When I did so, I found it hopeless enough to be risible. The moon soon came up, and since it was full, shone through the blind over the window, and let me see my makeshift prison fairly well. I listened carefully, but could hear no sound in the corridor outside. I stood up, went to the window, and pulled the blind aside a little. The room was on the second story at the front of the building, and the window was flanked on either side by a pair of stone goddesses. Anyone could have scaled that facade easily, for the stucco breasts, rumps, pillars, and pediments which covered it offered a multiplicity of foot and handholds. But on the window ledge itself, I would have been visible to any watcher in the square as if it had been daylight. And when I let the blind fall with a faint rattle, the sound provoked a volley of knocking on the door, so I knew the guard was wakeful. I looked around the room for a better exit, and my eyes fell upon the fireplace. It too was flanked by a brace of caryatids who bore the massive brown marble mantelpiece on their serene foreheads. In the grate was a screen embroidered with the town coat of arms. Although my shoulder was badly inflamed and I could hardly use my right hand, I managed to move the heavy screen without a clang or rattle, and I poked my head into the fireplace. Looking up, I saw a disk of pure blue sky on which shone a few stars. A light fall of soot showed my head and I withdrew it. But when I re-examined the interior of the chimney, I saw that, although caked with the soot of years, a series of clefts cut in the sides of it to facilitate the work of the chimney sweep made a staircase to the roof all ready for me. I could hardly believe my luck. I waited until I judged from the position of the moon it was some hours past midnight. By then my entire right arm was gripped rigid in a vice of pain, and of no further use. Besides, my rising fever parched and racked me, though there was nothing left to drink. and I had to fight against a growing light-headedness which verged on delirium. Yet, I was determined to escape. At last I crept to the door and listened. I thought I heard a faintly sawing snore, and, fevered as I was, this was enough to encourage me. I had been stripped of everything but my trousers and my badge. I was quite suitably dressed for climbing a chimney. I approached the fireplace. Dank powdered soot filled my mouth and nostrils, and, before I had effortfully ascended 3 or 4 yards, my left hand before me was as black as the wall in which it rested, and blood ran out of the rough bandaging trickling down my right arm. The sky watched me from above with a single blue eye that looked so blithely indifferent to my predicament that tears of self-pity carved deep channels in the filth on my cheeks. The sweep had used a child to clamber up and down the chimney for him with the brushes, but I was a grown man, and it was a chamber of unease to me, an unease which increased with every moment of tortured confinement. For my movements were too restricted to allow me to progress with any speed, and the necessity for absolute silence forbade me to so much as clear my throat. Besides, my overwrought senses soon convinced me the passage was steadily growing narrower, and the walls were shrinking to crush me. The building was some 6 stories high. I shuddered at every dark mouth announcing the fireplace of some other room, for fear a fall of soot would betray my ascent to anyone who waited there. And when, now and then, one-handed, I mishandled a cleft, I nearly died with fear to hear how my own struggle betrayed me. But up, up I went like an ambitious rat, traversing an unaccommodating horizontal hole, and I gradually grew certain there was nobody in the upper stories but my striving self. Yet for some reason this did not diminish my fear, for the memory of the blasted face of the dead girl visited me very often, and it seemed at times I still carried all her weight on my throbbing right arm, and saw her teeth gleam from a mess of poked flesh whenever I glanced down. At times the sky seemed a mile away, and at others I felt I could touch it if I stretched out my hand. So the moment when my head broke into the fresh air surprised me as much as if I were a baby suddenly popped from the womb. At first I could only drink the fresh air in thirsty gulps, still half wedged within the chimney. But as soon as I got my breath back, I managed to clamber perilously out of the stack and roll down the roof until I came to rest in the gutter, where I lay still for a long time, for I was almost at the end of my strength. The gutters were mercifully wide, and a pediment of carved stone some 3 feet high concealed the domestic look of the furniture of the roof from the street, so I, too, was quite hidden. As soon as I returned to myself a little, I saw that the moon was setting, and soon would come an hour or two of perfect darkness before the first signs of dawn. I waited for that darkness as for a friend. The dressings on my wound were so torn and filthy, I ripped them off and flung them away. A persistent dull pulse, like the pulse of pain itself, reminded me they had not taken out the bullet, and, unless I went to a doctor very soon, I might not last much longer. But I still had enough endurance left to escape. The nearest building was the town bank. It lay across a narrow alley a mere 6 feet away, and, by some miracle, it had a flat roof. But it was built on only 3 floors, so the drop was of some 18 feet. However, I could see the most inviting fire escape on the shady side of the building, which, if I could reach it, offered me a clear route to freedom. But I do not think I would have attempted that frightful downward plunge if my wits had not been shaking with fever. When it was quite dark, I made it. I pitched forward into the abyss, and the sprawling fall winded me completely, but I landed on the other side, alive. On this roof was a water tank, and though it contained no more than a puddle of scum, I scooped up a little in fingers where soot was now grained in the very whirls, and was refreshed in proportion to the quality of the refreshment. That is, not much, but a little. I could see the silver salver of the ocean dewed at the rim with a pale shadow of dawn, but otherwise the night was profound, for the street lights did not work anymore. So I walked down the fire escape on my bruised bare feet as bravely as you please, and crept off down the alleys, steering clear of guard dogs, keeping my eyes skinned for the gleam of a patrolling policeman's torch. Though the fever was in my eyes, and I trembled unnecessarily many times before I had left the town behind me. On my way, I stole fresh trousers and a shirt from a clothesline, and took the sandals from the feet of a drunken peasant sleeping in the doorway. But I did not stop to wash myself at any of the dripping water pumps. I waited until I came to a stream well away from the last of the suburbs, and there sluiced myself down with the icy water. I screamed out loud when it touched my wound. I buried my rag of an old garment under a stone and dressed myself in my new clothes. Now nothing at all was left of the brisk young civil servant who had left the city such a short while ago. I looked the perfect offspring of the ancestors my mother had so strenuously denied, and to that, perhaps, I owe my life. I came to the main road and found a telephone box where I tried to ring the minister, but all the lines were out of order or had been cut, for the instrument did not even crackle. So I left the highway and took a green path between hedgerows drenched with dew, where soon the sweet birds sang. The day had begun, and moment by moment the early morning mists grew brighter. I wished I did not keep glimpsing Marianne's face behind the hawthorns where the hips were red already. I passed a public house miles from anywhere, and resting against the rustic bench outside the door, wet with dew like everything else, lay a bicycle. I mounted the bicycle and rode on, though I could only steer with the one hand, for a bicycle may be ridden only by a continuous effort of will, and the will to live was all I had left. I do not possess a very clear memory of this part of my journey. I was consumed by a terrible sickness and weak from hunger, too. I had eaten nothing but the dead mayor's biscuits since the treacherous housekeeper's breakfast 24 hours before. I know I came to a very wide river towards the end of the morning and cycled along the embankment as the sun beat down on my uncovered head. My tires described great, crazy arcs behind me. I was now, I think, very near to the end. I saw a dappled horse cropping grass beside the path, and, leaning against a post, a tall, brown, rangy man in rough garments smoking a meditative pipe. He watched me curiously as I wobbled faintly towards him and held out his arms to catch me before I fell. I remember his lean, dark face, almost the face I had seen so recently in Marianne's mirror. And I remember the sensation of being carried through the air in a pair of strong arms, and then the creaking of boards and the motion of rocking on water. So I knew I had been placed in some kind of boat on the river. I recall the touch of fresh linen against my cheek and the sound of a woman's voice speaking a liquid and melodious language, which took me back to my earliest childhood, before the time of the nuns. Then, for a long time, nothing more. Chapter 3. The River People. The Portuguese did us the honor of discovering us towards the middle of the 16th century, but they had left it a little late in the day, for they were already past their imperious prime. And so our nation began as an afterthought or a footnote to other more magnificent conquests. The Portuguese found a tenuous coastline of fever-sodden swamp which, as they reluctantly penetrated inland, they found solidified to form a great expanse of sun-baked prairie. Lavishly distributing the white spirochete and the word of God as they went, they traveled far enough to glimpse the hostile ramparts of the mountains before they turned back, for there was no gold or silver to be had, only malaria and yellow fever. So they left it to the industrious Dutch a century later to drain the marshes and set up that intricate system of canals, later completed and extended during a brief visit by the British, to which the country was to owe so much of its later wealth. The vagaries of some European peace treaty or other robbed the Dutch of the fruits of their labors, although some of them stayed behind to add further confusion to our ethnic incomprehensibility and to the barbarous speech which slowly evolved out of a multiplicity of elements. But it was principally the Ukrainians and the Scots-Irish who turned the new fertile land into market gardens, while a labor force of slaves, remittance men, and convicts opened up the interior, and a Baroque architect imported for the purpose utilized their labors to build the capital, which was founded in the early 18th century at a point where the principal river formed an inland tidal basin. Here they built a house for Jesus, a bank, a prison, a stock exchange, a madhouse, a suburb, and a slum. It was complete. It prospered. During the next 200 years, a mixed breed of Middle Europeans, Germans, and Scandinavians poured in to farm the plains, and even though a brief but bloody slave revolt put a stop to slavery at the time of the French Revolution, enough black slaves ran away from the plantations of the northern continent to provide cheap labor in the factories, shipyards, and open-cast mines, which brought the country prosperously enough into the 20th century. You could not have said we were an undeveloped nation, though, if we had not existed, Dr. Hoffman could not have invented a better country in which to perform his experiments, and if he brought to his work the ambivalence of the expatriate, then were we not, except myself, almost all of us expatriates? Even those whose great-great-great-grandfathers had crossed the ocean in wooden ships felt in the atavistic presence of the foothills that they were little better than resident aliens. The expatriates had imposed a totally European facade on the inhospitable landscape in which they lived nervously, drawing around them a snug shawl of remembered familiarities, although with the years, this old clothing grew threadbare and drafts blew into the holes, which made them shiver. The very air had always been full of ghosts, so that the newcomers took their displeasure into their lungs with every breath. Until the introduction of DDT, the area between the capital and the sea was a breeding ground for fever mosquitoes. Until the drinking water was filtered, it was always full of cholera. The country itself was subtly hostile. It turned out that the extremely powerful bourgeoisie and by far the greatest part of the peasantry around the capital, from the rich farmers to the white trash, was of variegated European extraction, united by the frail bond of a language which, although often imperfectly understood, was still held in common, while the slum dwellers presented an extraordinary racial diversity, but were all distinguishable by the color black, for that pigmentation, to some degree, was common to them all. But if the conquistadors had found nothing they valued, the Jesuits who sailed with them discovered a rich trove of souls, and it is to the accounts of attempted conversions and the journals of those indefatigable stormtroopers of the Lord that we owe most of our knowledge of the Aborigines. Certain of the tribes and many of the customs the Jesuits ascribe to those days are certainly fallacious. The famous stories of Highlanders with such stiff, muscular spikes at the base of their spines that all their stools were perforated do not even need to be discredited. But not one of the tribes could write down the language they spoke, could tame horses, nor could build in stones. There were no Aztecs or Incas, but brown, naive men and women who fished, hunted, trapped birds, and then died in great numbers. For those who did not become running targets for the crossbows of the Portuguese, survived as quarries for the bluff English, who hallooed and tally-hoed after them in imported redcoats, while most of the rest succumbed to smallpox, syphilis, tuberculosis, or those sicknesses of the European nursery, measles and whooping cough, which proved deadly if exported to another hemisphere. But those defunct Amerindians had possessed a singular charm. Near the coast, a certain tribe had lived in reed hutches on islands in the marshes, and they used to paste feathers together to make themselves robes and mantles. So they darted about on stilts above the still water like brilliant birds with long legs. And they used to make tapestries which showed no figures, only gradations of color woven out of feathers in such a way the colors seemed to move. I have seen the tattered ruins of one of these feathered mantles in the unfrequented Museum of Folk Art. Ragged now, but still unwearied by time, the pink, reds, and purples still dance together. Another tribe which lived beside the sea, a glum, deferential people who subsisted on raw fish, had a dialect which contained no words for yes or no, only a word for maybe. Further inland, people lived in mud beehives which had neither doors nor windows, so you climbed into them through a hole in the roof. When the spring rains washed their homes away, as happened every year without fail, they stoically retired to caves where they carved eloquent eyes in stone for reasons the Jesuits never fathomed. Here and there, in the dry tundra and even the foothills, the Jesuits set the Indians, who were all sweet-natured and eager to please, to build enormous, crenellated churches with floral facades of pink stucco. But when the Indians had completed the churches and had gazed at them for a while with round-eyed self-congratulation, they wandered away again to sit in the sun and play tritonic melodies on primitive musical instruments. Then the Jesuits decided the Indians had not a single soul among them all, and that wrote a definite finis to the story of their regeneration. But not all the Indians died. The Europeans impregnated the women, and the children in turn impregnated the most feckless of the poor whites. The blacks impregnated the resultant cross, and, though filtered and diffused, the original Indian blood finally distributed itself with some thoroughness among the urban proletariat, and the occupations both whites and blacks deemed too lowly to perform, such as night soil disposal. Yet it was perfectly possible, and indeed by far the greater majority of the population did so, to spend all of one's life in the capital or the towns of the plain and know little, if anything, of the Indians. They were bogeymen with which to frighten naughty children, They had become rag pickers, scrap dealers, refuse collectors, and emptiers of cesspits. Those who performed tasks for which you did not need a face. And a few of them had taken to the river, as if they had grown to distrust even dry land itself. These were the purest surviving strain of Indian, and they lived secret, esoteric lives, forgotten, unnoticed. It was said that many of the river people never set foot on shore in all their lives, and I know it was taboo for unmarried girls or pregnant women to leave the boats on which they lived. They were secretive, proud, shy, and rigidly exclusive in their dealings with the outside world. Those who married outside the river clans were forbidden to return to their families, or even to speak to any member of the tribe again as long as they lived. But taboos against any kind of exogamy with the fat Caucasians who rooted themselves at ease along the river banks were so rigid. I do not think above half a dozen of the men, and among the men only the masters of the boats, or rather barges, had ever so much as exchanged a score of sentences with any except their own. Besides, they retained a version of one of the Indian dialects, and I rather think they were the remote and however altered descendants of the birdmen of the swamps. For the meaning of their words depended not so much on pronunciation as intonation. They speak in a kind of singing. When in the mornings a flock of womenfolk twitter about the barge emptying the slops over the side and getting the breakfast, it is like a dawn chorus. The only way to transcribe the language would be in a music notation. But I have found very few of their customs in the writings of the Jesuits. Over the years, their isolated and entirely self-contained society had developed an absolutely consistent logic, which owed little or nothing to the world outside, and they sailed from ports to cities to ports as heedlessly as if the waterways were magic carpets of indifference. I soon realized they were entirely immune to the manifestations. If the hawk-nosed, ferocious elders who handled their traditional laws said such a thing was so, then it was so. And it would take more than the conjuring tricks of a cunning landlubber to shake their previous convictions. Since, however, they bore no goodwill to the whites and very little to the blacks, if it came to that, they took a cool pleasure to witness from the security of their portholes the occasional havoc in the towns through which they passed. I blessed that touch of Indian blood my mother had all her life cursed, for it gave me hair black enough and cheekbones high enough to pass among the river people for one of their own, when they were the only ones who could help me. The barge master who took me in knew quite well I came from the city, but he spoke enough of the standard tongue to reassure me they were well disposed to fugitives from justice, provided they were of Indian extraction. He told me that during my faint he had dug the bullet out of my shoulder with a knife, while his mother held an infusion of narcotic herbs under my nose when I showed signs of regaining consciousness. Now he applied a boiling poultice of leaves to the wound, bandaged it, and left me in the care of the old woman. When she smiled at me, I thought at first she did not have a tooth in her head, for my eyes were still dim with fever. But soon I learned it was the custom for all the women to stain their teeth black. Every time she came into the cabin, she shut the door sharply behind her, but not before I saw a curious press of children crowding outside on deck to catch a glimpse of me. But I did not meet his family until Nau Kurai had taught me to sing something of his language. The speech of the river people posed philosophical as well as linguistic problems. For example, Since they had no regular system of plurals, but only an elaborate system of alternate numerals for denoting specific numbers of given objects, the problem of the particular versus the universal did not exist, and the word man stood for all men. This had a profound effect on their societization. Neither was there a precise equivalent for the verb to be. So the kernel was struck straight out of the Cartesian nut, and one was left only with the naked, unarguable fact of existence, for a state of being was indicated by a verbal tag, which could roughly be translated as, one finds oneself in the situation or performance of such and such a thing or action. And the whole aria was far too virtuoso a piece to be performed often, so it was replaced by a tacit understanding. The tenses divided time into two great chunks, a simple past and a continuous present. Neither contained further temporal shading. A future tense was created by adding various suffixes indicating hope, intention, and varying degrees of probability and possibility to the present stem. There was also a marked absence of abstract nouns, since they had very little use for them. They lived with a complex, hesitant, but absolute immediacy. Besides her blackened teeth, now Korai's mother, whom I was quickly invited to call Mama, used a great deal of paint on her face in spite of her age. The paint was applied in a peculiarly stylized manner. A coat of matte white covered her nose, cheeks, and forehead, but left her neck and ears as brown as nature made them. On top of this white crust, she put a spherical scarlet dot in the middle of each cheek, and over the mouth a precisely delineated scarlet heart which completely ignored the real contours of the lips, which one could make out beneath as vague indentations like copings under snow. Thick black lines surrounded her eyes, from which radiated a regular series of short spokes all around the circumference. The eyebrows were painted out and painted in again, some 3 inches above their natural position, giving her an habitual look of extreme surprise. Sometimes she would also paint in black a crescent, a star, or a butterfly at the corner of her mouth, on her temples, or in some other antique position. I could see that the young girls who came to peek at me were decorated in much the same way, though less elaborately. This traditional maquillage could not have originally been intended to repel landsmen, but, however fortuitously, it repelled them completely if ever one chanced to see it. Mama hid her coils of black hair in a colored handkerchief tied loosely over her head and knotted in the nape. She always wore loose trousers nipped in at the ankle with green or red cords, split-toed socks of black cotton which allowed her to keep thonged sandals on her feet, a loose blouse of checked or floral cotton, and protecting that, a short, immaculate, white starched apron which had armholes and tied at the back of both neck and waist, so that it covered her upper part almost completely. The aprons and also the bed linen and the curtains at the portholes were all trimmed with a coarse white lace the women made themselves in the evenings, 3 or 4 of them clustered round a single candle. I think it was a craft the nuns had taught them in the 17th century, before the river people signed their acquittance to the world, for the designs were very old-fashioned. Mama's costume was universal among the women. It gave them a top-heavy appearance, as if they could not fall down if you pushed, but only rock to and fro. I realized that, though I had sometimes seen the dark barges moving slowly along the river, I had never seen this characteristic shape of a woman on deck, and later I learned that the women were all ordered below whenever they reached a place of any size. Mama always smelled faintly of fish, but so did my sheets and blankets, and the smell had soaked into the very wood of the bulkhead beside me, for fish was their main source of protein. When she brought me my food, Mama never brought me a fork or knife or spoon to eat it with. She only brought a deep plate of a stiff kind of porridge made from maize topped with fish in a highly flavored sauce. And I was to discover the whole family habitually ate together round the round table in the main cabin, each scooping a handful of maize from the common bowl, rolling it in the palm until it was solid, and then dipping it into another common bowl and scooping up the sauce with it. Whenever she offered me my dinner, or dressed my wound, or washed me, or smoothed my bed, or undertook the more intimate tasks she performed without distaste or embarrassment, she used a limited repertoire of stiff, exact gestures, as if these gestures were the only possible accompaniments to her actions, and also the only possible physical expressions of hospitality, solicitude, or motherly care. Later I found that all the women moved in the same stereotyped way, like benign automata. So, what with that and their musical box speech, it was quite possible to feel they were not fully human and, to a certain extent, understand what had produced the prejudices of the Jesuits. The appearance and manners of the men were by no means so outlandish, perhaps because, although reluctantly, they were forced to mix more and more with the shore people, and so had adopted a rough version of peasant manners and also of peasant dress. They wore loose white shirts over loose trousers with a loose, sleeveless waistcoat, usually made from a web of small, knitted, multicolored squares, which they donned when the weather grew cool. In winter, both men and women would put on jackets of padded cotton. Mama was already patching and refurbishing a trunkful of these jackets ready for another season's wear. The men sometimes wore earrings and various talismans on chains around their necks, but did nothing to their faces except grow on them flamboyant mustaches, whose drooping lines traced the brooding shapes of the Indian nose and jaw. Since nobody offered to shave me, and I could not shave myself, I too sported one of those mustaches before I was up and about again. And once I was supplied with it, I did not bother to remove it, for I found I liked my new face far better than my old one. The weeks of pain and sickness passed with the remains of the summer. Through my porthole I saw the shorn cornfields of the great plain and the colors of autumn glowing and then falling from the trees. My best companion was the ship's cat, a thick-set, obese, skulking beast, white, with irregular black patches on the rump, the left forequarter and the right ear, who became very attached to me for some reason. Perhaps because I kept so still, he could sleep undisturbed on the warm cushion of my stomach for hours, where he made me throb with the vibrations of his purr. I was fond of him because he was painted up like Mama. When Nau Korai told me I was well enough to go on board, I saw that the entire boat was strung with chains made, each one of hundreds of little birds folded out of paper. And I learned this was not only to advertise to the other river dwellers the presence of a sick man on board, but was also an offering to the spirits who had caused my sickness. These birds increased my conviction that Nau Korai's tribe was descended from the painters in feathers. When I learned more of their medicine, however, I began to wonder why I had survived his doctoring. For Mama had sterilized the knife with which Nau Korai had performed his surgery by dipping it in the fresh urine of a very healthy virgin while reciting a number of antique mantras. Nau Korai occupied an important position in the tribe, and I was very lucky to have fallen under his protection. Their business consisted of the marine transportation of goods from one part of the Central Plain to another via the waterways. And since Dr. Hoffman had put the railways out of action, business was enjoying a boom. We drew behind us a whole string of barges which carried imported timber up to a city in the north, where work still went on as usual. The entire country was poorly afforested, and we were forced to import timber for building or even for the manufacture of furniture from other sources along the seaboard. Now could I own the longest string of barges among all the river people, and his skill at the standard speech and a remarkable flair for mental arithmetic had made him the spokesman and administrator for the whole community. To a considerable extent, the tribe held all its goods in common and tended to think of itself as a scattered but unified family. When I lived among them, there were some 500 or 600 river people who traveled mostly in convoys of 5 or 6 chains of barges each. But I should think their numbers have greatly dwindled since then. And perhaps by now they have all abandoned the river, the women have washed their faces for good, and they have become small tradesmen on dry land. Now Korai was a gaunt, hollow-eyed man of a somewhat embittered integrity, and, although he had a very quick intelligence and, indeed, considerable intellectual powers, even if he were extremely cynical, he was, like the entire tribe, perfectly illiterate. When I was well enough to get up every day, had enough phrases on the tip of my tongue to chirrup morning greetings to the family and could share the porridge bowl at meal times without spilling my food, now Korai took me more and more into his confidence, and finally told me he wanted me to teach him to read and write. For he was sure the shore people cheated him badly on all the consignments he undertook. When we stopped at a village, he sent one of his sons off to buy pencils, paper, and any book he could find, which happened to be a translation of Gulliver's Travels. So after that, every evening, when the barges were moored for the night, the supper cleared away and the horse attended to, we sat at the table under a swinging lantern, smoking and studying the alphabet, while the boys, under strict orders to be good, sulked in the corners or sat on the deck, too intimidated even to play quietly, while Mama and two of her daughters sat in smiling silence making lace, and the littlest girl belched and gurgled to herself like a faulty tap, for she was simple-minded. I had been given Naokorai's cabin, but he would not let me move out of it now that I was well again, though it placed a great strain on the sleeping quarters. For all the family had to fit themselves somehow into the main cabin by dint of hammocks slung from hooks and the mattresses spread on the boards. The only other room in the barge was a cramped galley where Mama prepared our meals on 2 little charcoal stoves, using extremely simple, even primitive utensils. There were 6 children. Now Korai's wife had died at the last birth, a boy now 3 years old. The eldest was also a boy who suffered from a hare lip. For 2 centuries of inbreeding had produced a generation of webbed hands, ingrowing eyelashes, lobeless ears, a number of other slight deformities, and, now Korai told me, a high rate of idiocy. The youngest daughter was 5 years old and still could only crawl. But his other children were strong and healthy enough. I still remember the 2 elder boys, strapping handsome lads, diving into the river every morning to wash. But I could not tell what the girls looked like because of their thick white crust. Even the 5-year-old was painted over, although she drooled so much it made the red and white grease run comically together. The next girl was 7, and the eldest 9. Though this one, Aoi, was a great big girl and worked hard all day at household chores under her grandmother's supervision, she still played with dolls. I often saw her cradling in her arms and lullabying a doll dressed like the river babies, a knitted skull cap on its head to stop the demons who grabbed hold of babies' top knots and pulled them bodily through the portholes, and the rest of it stuffed into a tailored sack to stop other demons who sucked out babies' entrails through their little fundaments. And the sack was bright red in color because red kept away the demons who gave babies croup, colic, and pneumonia. But when she offered me the doll so that I could play with it myself, I saw it was not a doll at all, but a large fish dressed up in baby clothes. Whenever the fish began to rot, Mama exchanged it for a fresh one just like it, so that, though the doll was always changing, it always stayed exactly the same. That she showed me the doll at all shows on what close terms I had grown with her. For even with their own menfolk, the girls displayed a choreographic shyness, giggling if addressed directly and hiding their mouths with their hands in a pretty pretense of being too intimidated to reply. But as the weeks went by, I grew more and more attuned to the slow rhythms and amniotic life of the river. I learned to trill their speech as well as anyone, and I became, I suppose, a kind of elder brother to them, although now Korai have hinted at certain plans for me which would make me closer than a brother. But I took no notice of him, because I thought Aoi was clearly too young to be married. As for myself, I knew that I had found a perfect place to hide from the determination police, and besides, some streak of atavistic, never-before-acknowledged longing in my heart now found itself satisfied. I was in hiding not only from the police, but from my minister as well, and also from my own quest. I had abandoned my quest. You see, I felt the strongest sense of homecoming. Soon my new language came to my tongue before my former one. I no longer relished the thought of any food except maize porridge and well-sourced fish. Even now, I carry the memory of that barge and my foster family warmly at my heart's core. I remember one evening in particular. It must have been late November, for the nights were chilly enough for Mama to have lit the stove. The stove burned wood, and its long chimney puffed smoke out above the cabin in a homely fashion. It warmed us with its great round metal belly that glowed red from the heat it contained. Mama set down the bowl of stiff porridge on the table, and Aoi brought us the bowl of stewed fish. Now Korai said a few words of pagan blessing over the food, and we began sedately to boil our porridge to a firm enough consistency to sustain its freight of fish. We ate sedately. We always ate sedately. And during the meal we exchanged a few domestic trivialities about the weather and the distance we had come that day. Aoi fed the youngest girl because she could not feed herself. The lamp above us moved with the motion of the boat at the whim of the current, and rhythmically now illuminated, now shadowed the faces around the table. I saw no strangeness in the whitened faces of the girls. They no longer looked like Pierrots in a masquerade, for I knew each individual feature under the cosmetic, the hollow in the seven-year-old's cheek that showed where she had lost the last of her milk teeth the previous week, and the little scratch the cat had given Aoi's nose. And Mama looked just as every mother in the world should look. The limited range of feeling and idea they expressed with such a meager palette of gesture no longer oppressed me. It gave me, instead, that slight feeling of warm claustrophobia I had learned to identify with the notion home. I dipped my fist into the pungent stew And for the first time in my life, I knew exactly how it felt to be happy. The next day we came into the town of T, and the girls all went below when we moored beside the woodyard. Now Korai asked me to go with him to the wood merchant, and so I left the barge for the first time since I had boarded it. I found I was walking with a rolling gait. I was able to convince him that the wood merchant, at least, was one of the honest swordsmen. But when we went to the market to get in stocks of maize for the long journey back down the river, I was able to render the river people a service, which now Korai valued more highly than it was worth. T was a small, old-fashioned town, so far to the inland north, that a few sandstone outcrops of the mountains lay beyond the river. Yet here life seemed relatively unaffected by the war, and people went about on daily business as if it were nothing to them that the capital had been cut off for 3.5 years. This sense of suspended time comforted me. It made me feel that the capital, the war, and the minister had never existed anyway. I had quite forgotten my black swan and the ambiguous ambassador, for I had come back to my people. And Desiderio himself had disappeared because the river people had given me a new name. It was their custom to change a given name if someone had suffered bad luck or misfortune, as they guessed I had done. So now I was called Kiku. The two syllables were separated by the distance of a minor third. The name meant foundling bird. It seemed to me most wistfully appropriate. In a marketplace, peasant farmers displayed baskets of gleaming eggplants, world peppers, slumbrously overripe persimmons and blazing tangerines, all fruits of late autumn. There were coops of live chickens, tubs of butter and cartwheel cheeses. There were stalls for toys and clothes, cloth by the yard, candy and jewelry. A ballad singer stood up on a stone to give us a vocal demonstration of his Irish origins, and a bear in an effeminate hat trimmed with artificial daisies lumbered through the parody of a waltz in the arms of a gypsy woman with red ribbons in her hair. The marketplace was full of the liveliest bustle, and there were enough Indian faces in the crowds of country people to make us feel a little more at ease than we usually did on dry land. For this town was a kind of headquarters for the river people, for reasons I was to learn later. First we went to the corn chandlers and ordered 14 stone of hulled maize to be delivered to the boat. Then we wandered about the market making Mama's commission of purchases. As they thrust 3 squawking chickens into paper bags for us, a man whose features and dress showed he was one of the clan came rushing up breathlessly and poured out a complaint as dramatically as Verdi. Paired of the histrionic grace notes, it was a simple story. He had brought a consignment of grain from the plains to a seed broker here. He had made his mark on a contract he could not read with the farmer, and now the broker claimed he had contracted to carry a whole 2 tons more than had now been removed to the godowns, and our brother Inui must pay the difference from his own pocket, which would ruin him. Tears ran down his brown cheeks. He was fat, old, poor, and quite at a loss. "This will be easy to settle," said Naukurai. "Kiku here can read and write, you see." Inui's eyes grew round with awe. He bowed to me stiffly and made 1 or 2 flattering remarks in a heightened language of respect they used when they wished to honor somebody's skill or beauty, for they loved to abnegate themselves before one another. So we went all 3 together to the seed broker's. On the way, in a glass of a shop window, I saw the reflections of 3 brown men in loose, white, shabby clothes, with tattered straw hats pulled down over our oblique eyes, a deep thatch of black hair above our upper lips, and below austere noses that express contempt for those unlike themselves in the very whorls of our nostrils. I could have been Nao Korai's eldest son or youngest brother. This idea gave me great pleasure. The seed broker was